Hey guys, and welcome to the Animal Training Academy podcast show. I'm your host, Ryan Cartledge, and I'm really excited that you have decided to take time out of your busy schedules to come and hang out today. We're really grateful for you tuning in. And if you have been listening to the podcast for a while, we really appreciate this. Thank you so much. Hopefully you have subscribed so that you never miss an episode. But if not, or if you are new to the show, get yourself over to iTunes, Stitcher, animaltrainingacademy.com, or whatever it is you're listening to this podcast on, and hit the subscribe button to make sure you don't miss a single episode. We are bringing you today's episode on behalf of the Animal Training Academy, or ATA, membership. If you like the conversations in these podcasts, then I want to invite you to continue them with like-minded people within the ATA membership area, which you can find out more about over on the ATA website. Within the membership, you can get access to twice monthly live web classes, the back catalogue of previous web classes, plus a huge library of videos and projects to problem solve different training situations. And we're a sociable bunch with an exclusive private Facebook group, forums area, and WhatsApp chat groups. It's like a Netflix social media platform for animal behavior nerds. But we will get started on today's episode, where we will be talking to one Dr. Vanessa Rolfe. Dr. Vanessa Rolfe is a consultant, counsellor, and educator to those who work with and care for animals. She has a PhD with a specialisation in psychology, human-animal interactions, a Bachelor of Arts with honours in psychology, and has worked in the animal industry for over 15 years. Vanessa has additional qualifications in mindfulness, animal bereavement, and compassion fatigue. Vanessa is co-founder of the initiative People and Animals in the Workplace, member of the Anthrozoology Research Group, and has lectured and tutored psychology and human behaviour for over 7 years. She also holds an honorary role at La Trobe University and regularly presents her work at international and national conferences, as well as through peer-reviewed journal articles. Vanessa provides high-quality and informed support services and has worked with a number of animal care industries, including animal shelters, veterinary clinics, zoos, dog training, walking, and daycare facilities, and regularly provides individual counseling, consultations, and workshops to companion animal owners and animal care professionals from a range of industries. So without further ado, it's my very great pleasure to welcome Vanessa to the show today, who is patiently waiting by. Vanessa, how are you?
I'm really well. I'm so excited to be here. Thanks for having me.
You're our first podcast. We're excited to get you on here, and we're surprised you haven't been on many podcasts before with your impressive resume that we just read out.
This is my very first podcast. It's very exciting.
And please pass our gratitude on to the person who is kindly looking after your youngest and newest member of the family today, so we can jump on here together and record this.
Yes, I will. Thank you. It's nice to be speaking to
Sorry, you go.
It's nice to be speaking to an adult.
At home, yeah, I can imagine. I spend all day with my dog as well, so I feel the same way. It's nice to have some human contact. No, I'm just joking. Hey, let's dive straight into the first question today, Vanessa. Could you please take everyone listening back to how you got started in this very interesting, and I'm going to label it, and you can tell me if you might label it differently, but I'm going to label it as very niche field that you are in. How did you get started in this? What made you decide to follow this route?
Yeah, it is a really niche area, and when I explain to people what I do, I do have to explain it, because it is quite a niche area. But I guess it really all started when I was a veterinary nurse, which was many, many years ago in my early 20s. I began vet nursing, and I imagine, like many young people, you start vet nursing and thinking of all the good things associated with vet nursing, patting puppies and all the good stuff. Didn't really consider the fact that I was going to be exposed to so much trauma and grief that I was, and I really wasn't prepared for it. And while I did learn on the job and there was many rewarding aspects, what I wanted to do was I wanted to find out more about how I could support people who were experiencing trauma and who was experiencing grief. So I went back to uni and I did my honours and I looked at euthanasia-related traumatic stress. I researched that area and then went on and I did my PhD, as you were saying, looking at human-animal interactions. So it's really something that I've been wanting to do for a long time, and then working in animal welfare research. And then I decided just about 2.5 years ago to go out on my own and start my business, where I really just want to support people that work with animals, because I just felt like when I first started, it really wasn't something that was talked about very often. And there really wasn't a lot of support out there for animal care professionals, and there wasn't a lot of support out there for animal owners when they lose their companion animal. So I just wanted to look after those that look after animals.
And so was it a specific event during those early days that kind of, let's say, pushed you over the edge and made you go, okay, I've got to take this to the next level, I've got to kind of explore this area more? Or what was that journey from this change in your mindset from, yay, let's go pet some puppies, to, oh crap, I've got to go to university and learn more?
Yeah, that's a really good question. And I guess there wasn't really a critical incident as such. It was really a gradual progression. I always wanted, it sounds really corny, but when I was younger, I started like a little helping people club, because I always wanted to help people, but I loved animals as well. So it sounds so corny, but I really wanted to do both. And so I guess my skills and my background really just lent towards this area. So I get to do both, which is fantastic.
What is a helping people club, Vanessa? What does that look like? Unpack that for us.
I was only 6 at the time.
Nice. Wow.
Hadn't thought through it that much. But I guess, yeah, I guess when I was younger, I just always wanted to help people. So I always had that interest in counselling, but also wanted to help animals too. So I guess the two kind of progressed along each other. And what I found was that there really was not a lot of support out there. So there was support lacking for people, animal caregivers. So that's where I was drawn to.
And then you did your PhD, and congratulations on that. That is something that should be to shout to everyone that has gone through that. It's no easy task. So you mentioned at that point you were studying euthanasia, so stress of people around euthanasia. Was that what your PhD was on, or did that kind of lead up to you doing your PhD?
Yeah, so I did my honours research looking at euthanasia-related traumatic stress in animal caregivers. Then I was taught psychology, undergraduate psychology, for about 8 years, and during that time I did my PhD with a specialisation in psychology, but I looked at how owner attitudes predict responsible dog ownership behaviours. So I broadened out my research in that area, but still looking at the human psychology and how that impacts on animals and our behaviour towards animals.
I'm curious to hear what you found in your PhD. You said it was looking at owner attitudes and how that helped predict responsible pet ownership?
Yeah, that's right. Yes. So what I found was that indeed our attitudes do predict the way that we behave towards our dogs and towards responsible dog ownership behaviours. So, for example, if you have positive attitudes towards de-sexing, you're more likely to de-sex your dog. So, for example, if you think that de-sexing your dog is good for their health or good for their behaviour, you're more likely to do so. So in that way, attitudes predict a number of behaviours. So de-sexing, the way we microchip our dogs, whether we exercise our dogs, whether we overfeed our dogs. But also what I found which was quite interesting, was that we really care about what other dog owners and what our vets and what other people think about what we do. So if we believe that the behavior we're going to do, we're going to carry out, is going to be supported by others and approved of by others, then we're more likely to do so. So that was a really interesting part of the research.
And has this been I'm kind of going off track here, but it sounds pretty interesting. Is this an area that a lot of other people have studied? And then kind of, I'm just thinking how we can use the creation of positive attitudes to influence things like the use of shock collars, maybe.
Yeah, that's a really good point. I'm not aware of any research that's looked at attitudes towards the use of shock collars, but it's certainly a model that can be applied to any behaviour that we carry out towards animals. So the theory is a theory of planned behaviour. And according to that theory, there are our attitudes predict behaviour, as well as whether we have perceived control over that behaviour, whether we believe that we can carry that behaviour out, and what we think others think about that behaviour. So this is a theory that's been used to understand how attitudes predict a lot of health-promoting behaviours in towards ourselves, so smoking behaviour, for example. So the results of my research are particularly useful for those that want to develop campaigns where we can encourage responsible dog ownership behaviour. So it's useful in, because I looked at a lot of health behaviours as well as a lot of responsible dog ownership behaviours like registration and microchipping. So the results are really quite useful for a number of health promoting campaigns, a number of responsible dog ownership campaigns.
Yeah, I'm thinking about my own life, and we keep our cats inside, but we have a netted backyard.
Yeah.
And I know that if non-animal people come visit us, I feel, and I know I shouldn't be saying this, but sorry, wifey, but wifey kind of thinks that if non-animal people come over, that she gets potentially a little bit embarrassed because of the perceived attitudes about cat ownership. Whilst if my zoo folk come over or my animal-related friends, they're all like, oh, yeah, of course, that's awesome. I love what you're doing. You're helping support conservation. And she's very much like, she might even like tell different stories. We're doing it to help the birds versus we're doing it so they don't get run over on the road.
Yeah. It's a really interesting point, and it does depend on the person. So with the research that I did, there's also, you know, we care about what others think, but there is a different level of motivation to comply with them as well. So, for example, what I found with my research is that people were more motivated to comply with what other dog owners thought rather than perhaps what their friends and family thought. So I can see the same with your situation there too, it seems.
And you said something about perceived control of behaviour. What does that mean?
Yeah. So perceived control is, I guess, about how much control you think you have over the behaviour. So, for example, people may believe that they may have positive attitudes towards confinement, for example, but if they believe they don't have control over that behaviour, it may impact on whether they do so. So, for example, if people live on acreage, if they live on a large property, they may have positive attitudes towards confinement, but they may have a low perceived control because, for example, refencing is going to cost a lot of money, and it's going to be they may not have time. So all these kind of barriers can affect their whether they believe they have control over the behaviour. So that's when I talk about perceived behavioural control. That's what we talk about, what we think about.
I feel that there's another whole podcast episode here different than what we had planned to talk about. So we will move on, but I'm also interested in you because you said you did some research on animal welfare.
Yeah, so when I finished my PhD, I worked for the Animal Welfare Science Centre at the University of Melbourne, and I worked on a stock person behaviour program, so education program, where we looked at – the program's called ProHand. And it's all about motivating people that work with stock animals, so pigs, for example. What we found was that the same kind of attitude theory predicts behaviours towards stock animals. So if the stock person had positive attitudes towards pigs, for example, they're more likely to carry out positive behaviours towards their pigs, which therefore led to less fearful pigs. So what we did was design an education program which targeted those attitudes and knowledge to promote more positive behaviours towards stock animals.
So what kind of stuff was included in those educational programs? Like what? How did you do
that? Yeah. So we looked at what we did was we provided people with a lot of information about pigs, that pigs are really intelligent animals. So we provided them with that that information. And we also provided them with information that showed that if pigs are treated in a more positive manner, they're actually much easier to handle. So it makes the job of the stock person a lot easier.
And so this led to less fearful pigs, behaviours we might label as less fearful. That's awesome. Yeah. I mean, there's a lot of generalisation we could do from that.
Yes.
So thank you very much for sharing.
You're welcome.
Hey, can you, just before we move on to the meat of the episode, for those of us who might want to find out a little bit more about you and what you do, where can people go to find you online and get in touch, etc.?
Yes, well, I've got a website. I'm also available on all the social media outlets. So I'm on Facebook. I post a lot on Facebook and Instagram and LinkedIn as well. But you can also find me on my website, which is drvanessarolf.com.au.
Cool. We will link to the stuff in the podcast write-up as well, so it's nice and easy for you to go and find everyone. And I just realised that we forgot to touch on one thing that you're doing, which is really exciting and I want to learn more about. And we mentioned it in the bio, but this is people and animals in the workplace. So this is is venture the right word to use to describe it? What is your venture, air quotes, people and animals in the workplace?
Yeah, well, this is a really exciting initiative between Dr. Kate Mornament and Mia Cobb and myself. So we're a joint initiative and we've all come together to provide professional development offerings to people that work with animals. So we deliver evidence-based understanding in animal behaviour, training, welfare and human wellbeing. So I concentrate on the human wellbeing side and Dr. Kate Mornament and Mia Cobb concentrate on the animal well-being side of things. So our last event was held in May and we focused specifically on people that work in the animal sheltering sector, and it was a massive success. So we've got some exciting things planned for this year and next year. So a whole bunch of seminars in the pipeline. So yeah, it's good stuff.
And that's based in Melbourne, or are you spreading your feelers or tentacles or I don't know what word to use?
We might be. So we originally, our first one was held in Melbourne, but yeah, we've got some exciting things coming where, you know, we may be travelling to a place near you.
New Zealand. Yeah. Is that what I'm picking up there? And for those of you who want to learn more about Dr. Kate Mornament, we do have a past podcast episode with her. So I'll link to that in this podcast write-up as well. And Mia Cobb as well. We haven't had the pleasure of interacting with Mia Cobb via Animal Training Academy, but maybe, because she's coming to New Zealand, possibly.
Well, we have to make sure we get lots of people that want us there, and then we might. But Mia Cobb is very, very clever, very clever. Good person to speak to.
Sounds like a dangerous trio. Dangerous in so much as the spreading of awesome information. Not super dangerous, but...
Lots of
awesomeness. Fantastic. Hey, thanks so much for sharing everything so far, Vanessa. I love hearing about people's stories and how they got started. Moving forward, though, I'd like to talk about some of the areas that within this venture that we just talked about, you're specialising in. And the first one of these is compassion fatigue. Can you please talk to this for us, Vanessa? Maybe start off with a definition of what compassion fatigue is.
Yeah. So I guess just to give a little bit of background, when I did my honours and I was looking at euthanasia traumatic stress, and I guess what I found was that euthanasia wasn't the only stressful factor that was affecting animal care professionals. So I guess this is really what got me started looking into the area of compassion fatigue. So what I found was with the honours research was that 50% of the sample reported traumatic stress symptoms from their exposure to euthanasia, but that also meant that there was 50% that were coping quite well. But what I found with that research was that euthanasia wasn't the only stressful factor. So people were citing things like conflicts between the needs of the client and the animal as being quite stressful. caring for suffering animals, just being exposed to trauma, consoling grieving and sometimes traumatized owners, combined with the physical hazards associated with working with animals, like the risk of injury or exposure to disease. So these were all stressful factors that I wasn't really picking up on with the honors research. So what I found was that it's more than just euthanasia-related stress. It's much larger. And what I was looking at actually, what it seems to be what was happening was that people were experiencing what we call compassion fatigue. And so compassion fatigue is associated with two things. So the first one is secondary trauma. And secondary trauma is a kind of traumatic stress reaction that you get when you're exposed to trauma and suffering. So what happens is that people take on the trauma and experience it, although that's actually happening to them. So the symptoms associated with secondary trauma kind of mimic those that are associated with post-traumatic stress. So people may experience traumatic stress symptoms like hypervigilance. So they may feel quite irritable. They may be scanning the environment for stresses, so feeling hypervigilant. They may feel jumpy. They may have intrusive symptoms as well, so intrusive thoughts or distressing recollections of a traumatic event, and they may have nightmares. So these are some of the traumatic stress symptoms that people experience. So that's secondary trauma. That's the first factor associated with compassion fatigue. The second factor is burnout. Now, burnout occurs when we're exposed to multiple chronic workplace stresses. So things like high workloads and little resources really to deal with those workloads. So burnout is associated with feelings of overwhelm, just feeling like you can't get on top of things, feeling just physically and emotionally exhausted, and also feelings of cynicism, like that feeling like, oh, it doesn't matter what I do, nothing makes a difference. Again, just feeling really quite stressed and overwhelmed. And so these are the two factors that are associated with compassion fatigue, so secondary trauma and burnout. And it's not just those that are working in the veterinary clinic that can experience compassion fatigue. Compassion fatigue affects all people that are in a caring role. So this involves people that are caring for people as well as people that are caring for animals. So when we think about it, we can includes animal trainers, those that are behaviourists, those that work in the zoo environment, even people that work in doggy daycare that are doing dog walking or training or anywhere really where we're in a caring role, we can be susceptible to compassion fatigue.
So to try to recap that.
Yeah.
Firstly, you're doing your research on euthanasia-related stress. Is that?
Yeah.
And then you realise that 50% of people were reporting stress, so you kind of went, there's 50% that aren't reporting stress, so what's going on there? And there were lots of different factors, but one of the main ones was compassion fatigue, would you say? Or was that 50% yes. of them were having compassion fatigue? Or?
So originally when I went into to do this research, I looked just at euthanasia traumatic stress, but one of the questions I asked was what are the most stressful factors associated with your work? And while exposure to euthanasia was one of the stressful factors, it wasn't the only one. So we had a lot of areas where people were getting stressed, and it was the workload, it was conflicts between the client and the animal, it was exposure to suffering, it was times where people wanted to ease suffering and couldn't, as well as situations where they're exposed to, I guess, workplace hazards like the risk of injury and disease. So euthanasia certainly wasn't the only stressful factor. So really this was more associated with compassion fatigue rather than solely euthanasia-related traumatic stress.
And so then you kind of broke it down into two areas, secondary
yeah.
trauma.
Yeah, so when I realised that that animal care professionals are actually impacted by compassion fatigue, when I researched that area, what we find is that a researcher called Stam, he considers compassion fatigue to consist of two things. So the first one is secondary traumatic stress and the second one is burnout.
Right, and so we might self-diagnose Is that, I don't know if it's something you recommend, but you might be listening to this podcast and wondering if you have compassion fatigue. And so you might notice things in yourself, such as hypervigilance, scanning the environment, intrusive thoughts of traumatic events, and even so far as nightmares. That's pretty invasive on your life, isn't it?
That's right. And so, you know, while it might be tempting, sometimes we can experience these symptoms in isolation. But what you might find is if you're experiencing any of these symptoms, like your traumatic stress symptoms, like intrusive symptoms, nightmares, hypervigilance, if you're also experiencing feelings of just overwhelm, sadness and exhaustion, they may be signs of compassion fatigue. But what we also want to consider is that compassion fatigue really, you would say that someone has compassion fatigue is if it is affecting their life and if they are experiencing these symptoms for, say, a month, more than a month.
And so to kind of take all of that and then to look at the two words that make up compassion fatigue, is it just being tired of being compassionate? Is that another way of saying it, or is that too simplistic?
Yeah, it's a tricky term. So when we look in the literature, there are multiple definitions of compassion fatigue. So some people consider compassion fatigue as, tired of caring. So others consider compassion fatigue as just being the same as secondary trauma. But what we really want to think of is compassion fatigue is a special form of burnout that affects caregivers. So if you are, you know, if you are concerned that you have compassion fatigue, there is actually a test that you can do. STAM has developed a professional quality of life scale, which you can actually get access to for free online, and you can download, and it's really easy to self-score and to check out your levels, your risk levels on both secondary trauma and burnout.
I want to do this test. I self-diagnosed myself as having compassion fatigue when I was working in zoos. Yeah. And I feel kind of bad about it. Like right now I feel bad about it. And it was because let me tell you a little bit of history and you can potentially provide some feedback. And I think the next step for me would be to go check out this test. Yeah. Although it's been a while since I've been in employment in the zoo industry. But for example, animals dying and stuff in zoos, looking after large amounts of animals and animals getting sick. And it was, with anyone in a care-based role, something that happened regularly enough. And I'll compare myself to younger people into the industry, and I could see that there was a lot more of a impact upon them with regards to death and sickness and accidents. And I found myself numb to it to a certain degree after a while. And then I saw someone do a talk at a zoo conference here on compassion fatigue a couple of years ago, and it kind of helped me to put a label on it. Go on.
Yeah, I agree, Ryan. I think it really does help to know that there is a thing out there called compassion fatigue, that if people are experiencing these symptoms, that they're not alone. They're not the only people that are experiencing these symptoms, because it can be really isolating if you're going through this. And what you mentioned, Ryan, there was that there is a difference, you were saying, I guess, between what you were seeing those that had just entered the occupation to compare to yourself. Emotional numbing certainly is one of the symptoms that is associated with compassion fatigue. And when we're in a caring role, you know, it's a really delicate balance between caring, but not caring so much that we become overwhelmed. So, you know, it's a delicate balance, and there certainly are, you know, pathways to burnout where people can find themselves on that gradual decline between burnout and compared to when they first started, there is a slow progression.
And I feel like I felt kind of bad for not having, for feeling numb. And then I felt like, and I'm being very open here, and I'm and it's placed me in a spot of vulnerability because I am also conscious of my own perception of how people of the audience might perceive me now if I'm sharing this. But I used to look at younger keepers, and everyone's an individual, obviously, and there might have been keepers that have been there for a while, and kind of find it challenging that they were so affected by something. But I also felt bad, like, and so maybe Something that you and Noel are going to talk about is the appropriateness, not appropriateness, that's the wrong word, but the safety of talking about this kind of stuff and sharing it with each other in those fields. Is that something you find, that people feel bad for having compassion fatigue and therefore it makes it hard to talk about?
Yeah, I really do. And as you were talking, I really feel for you, Ryan, because you're certainly not alone in feeling that. I do speak to people that experience these symptoms, and then they pile on judgments onto themselves because, you know, we're all in an animal caring environment. We all have empathy, we all have compassion, and when we have these feelings of anger or sadness, bitterness, or when we just feel numb, then we can actually pile on these judgments of ourselves and say, well, God, that must mean I'm a horrible person, I shouldn't be feeling these things. And unfortunately, that can actually make compassion fatigue much worse. It can intensify symptoms as well. So you're certainly not alone in feeling that. People do feel like perhaps, or there's something wrong with me, that means I'm not a caring person. But certainly, you know, the fact that there is a term out there, compassion fatigue, and that there are these symptoms associated with it, if that's any consolation, you know, it shows that this is certainly what happens to many animal care professionals.
Yeah, and I think I found myself in that position wanting to feel more. Like, I was like, yeah. Feel more, Ryan, feel more. And so what advice maybe can you give to 2015, Ryan? or let's choose another field, dog trainers who might be working with aggressive cases, and or just any dog trainers who are trying to help owners and their dogs and putting in intervention strategies for behaviours, and owners not following through with it, and them starting to feel like, you know, they can't be bothered, what's the point, becoming hyper-vigilant to those things, feeling a little bit of overwhelm, all of these things that we've been talking about. And maybe they go online, they do this test, and they find that, yes, the computer tells them they are having things associated with compassion fatigue. What's the next step?
What's the next step? So the next step is, well, first off, I would congratulate people in doing the first one, because they've actually already done it, because awareness is the first step. So becoming aware of the signs and symptoms of compassion fatigue, recognizing them in yourself is the first thing that you can do. The second thing that you can do is to try and look at some ways that you can create some balance in your life. So you want to have a think about where are you allocating your time and your resources? You know, think about your friends, your family, your workplace. Where are you allocating your time, and trying to create some balance in that? So make sure that you're spending time in other areas other than work. So to try and maintain some balance. Also, having some boundaries is a really important way to manage compassion fatigue as well. So having some boundaries means that could mean setting up some clear work hours. Now, if we're working for ourselves, that can be really difficult. I know myself, I have my own business, and, you know, when you've got emails and you've got constant notifications, and, you know, you've got your social media that you want to keep up, it can be really hard to create some boundaries between your work life and your home life. But it's a really great way to try and maintain some balance and to get some perspective. So creating some balance there between your work life and home life, setting some work hours, some clear work hours, and also monitoring your exposure to trauma as well. So if we're in a workplace where we're being exposed to a lot of trauma, a lot of suffering, you want to limit your exposure when you get home as well. So that might mean, I know myself when I'm on Facebook, there are a lot of traumatic stories that come up on Facebook. I'm not saying don't stay on top of current events, but it might mean you have to be quite vigilant and limit your exposure to trauma. But also balance means that you want to engage in activities that energize you and relax you as well. So that's the second thing that you can do. So the first one's awareness. The second one is practice some balance. The third one would be looking at some connections. So make sure you have some good connections with people that you work with. Now, sometimes if we're working for ourselves, we can become quite isolated. So it's important to reach out and get some support from your peers, from your mentors. So I think your Animal Training Academy is fantastic in that people can really come together and support each other. So that's a really great way to help and connect with your animals as well. Connect with animals at home. So what can happen with people that have compassion fatigue, they may have lost sight of the whole reason that they started working in the animal care environment in the first place. So without judgment, again, just trying to reconnect with animals is a really great way to manage compassion fatigue, I think. And it might be just starting in a little way, just looking, spending some time with your pets at home if you have companion animals at home, reconnecting that way. So connections with friends and family, connections with your peers and connections with animals as well is another great way to manage compassion fatigue. But also, one more tip is, you mentioned at the start that I've got some training in mindfulness. And I think mindfulness is a really great tool to manage compassion fatigue. In fact, the research shows that it significantly does reduce compassion fatigue symptoms. Mindfulness is all about being present, having non-judgmental awareness in the present moment. So what can happen with compassion fatigue is that we might find ourselves getting sad or angry. You might find, like you were saying, Ryan, feeling emotionally numb. And then we pile extra judgments onto that feeling. Now, taking a mindful attitude, what we want to do is experience those emotions without judgment. What we find is that emotions can be quite transient and they can pass. And sometimes our reaction to emotions can make them worse, can intensify them. So some people might find that they're trying to push these emotions away. What can happen if you do try and push them away, then they tend to come back tenfold. So having a mindful attitude can be really helpful as well.
Is that kind of called emotional intelligence? Is that another way of saying it? Or is that something separate?
So mindfulness is a separate concept to emotional intelligence, but emotional intelligence certainly is linked with reduced compassion fatigue symptoms as well. So that's being able to identify your emotions and how to manage them, and also being aware of the emotions of others as well is really important too.
So for those who might be in a team, because we talked about team then and the importance of potentially surrounding yourself with and connecting with people that help support you. And I'm thinking about my own experience from Animal Training Academy, and I know you and I were talking about this and focusing on animal behaviour and training, and as the community grows, the tribe grows around Animal Training Academy and the membership, I realise more and more the focus on actual helping people out with experiencing emotions, which is what you're just talking about, and not judging themselves and learning how to do it myself. Like, I can't, I'm not in this position to teach people, and there might be people in teams as well that are managing teams that don't feel they have that skill set to help people with this kind of stuff, because you know we're focusing on animal training, or we're focusing on dog walking, or we're focusing on caring for people. But how big of a part of what we do is it, would you say? Like, if we've got an animal training business, myself, or we've got a dog walking business, someone else, how much should we focus on making sure people are treating themselves well around this stuff? Does that make sense? Does my question make sense?
So you're wondering how much we should concentrate on supporting those that we work with?
Yeah, in a way. Let's go with that and see if it answers my question.
Okay. All right. Okay. So, look, I think if we want to sustain a career in a caregiving role, and we are, you know, if you're working in animal training, you are in a caregiving role because you're dealing with owners' needs. Owners will often come to you probably in a quite an anxious state, in a stressful state. You're also caring for animals that are in an anxious or stressful state. So we're in a caregiving role there for animal trainers. We want to make sure that to have a sustainable career, you've got to make sure that this is a marathon, not a sprint. So, you know, managing emotions is all part of that. And being aware of your own well-being is all part of that if you want to have a sustainable career in this environment. And, you know, looking after each other, I think is a really is something that we want to be mindful of, certainly. It does play a big role if we want to have a supportive work environment, because we do know that when people do work in supportive work environments, they're less likely to experience burnout, compassion fatigue, and other forms of stress.
So for someone who rings you up and says, hey, Vanessa, can you come into to our organisation and talk to the staff about this? Like, where are they on their journey? Have they gone, holy crap, we have a problem, we've never talked about it, we need help? Or are you going in there going, okay, cool, this is safe to talk about? Or are you going in there to an area where it's already safe to talk about and offering and building upon ideas they already have? Or what kind of space do you find that you're entering organisations in?
Yeah, that's a really good question. So what I found is that it really depends on the workplace. But the really fantastic thing that I'm finding is that a lot of workplaces now are really proactive when it comes to mental health. Certainly when I compare, say 20 years ago, I think things are so much better now. I think workplaces are much more proactive when it comes to promoting mental health in the workplace. Because, you know, if we're promoting mental health in the workplace, then we know that we have happy workers, and happy workers are productive workers as well. So we're less likely to get work staff turnover, we're less likely to get sick leave, and we're much more likely to have productive workers if we maintain and promote well-being in the workplace.
And one more question I have is do you know of any research, and this is a Ryan anecdotal story he tells himself, so wants to explore it as any research to back it up. Does this kind of is there an evolution that statistically people might be more likely to follow with regards to developing compassion fatigue? For example, you said you went in and, you know, you're really excited as a nurse, and over time it kind of gradually chipped away at you. And I found that in my experience, you know, when I started in the zoo career, maybe I was a lot more influenced by specific individual events. But I found in myself, over time, I developed my boundaries. So maybe I became aware of it, and then I set more clear work hours. And stuff like this, and I feel like looking at my peers when I was in employment, they were doing the same things. Younger greener keepers, myself included, when I started, might be willing to stay late and willing to do all the research on their weekend and spend their whole weekend dedicated to work. So, does my question make sense? And secondly, can you offer some input on that?
Yeah. When it comes to the research, I'm not aware of any research which has looked at specific pathways to burnout, but we do know that, you know, anecdotally there are certain pathways to burnout. So what you're describing is, you know, similar to what I did, you know, you enter the occupation, you're keen as, you work overtime, your boss might says, can you do these extra tasks? And you're like, yeah, I'm the first one there. You do everything you can, and you live and you breathe your cause. And then what can happen is people can start getting quite frustrated. So people might get frustrated that they're doing all these extra work, they're not seeing any changes taking place, and then they can start to get angry. And then this anger can sometimes burn out itself, and it can turn into cynicism. So there's certain, yeah, definitely, I think that there are some pathways to burnout. So, you know, that's why awareness is really important, because if we can become aware, you know, even of the early signs of stress, and take steps to relieve that stress, then the ideal would be that we prevent compassion fatigue altogether.
Yeah, great input. Looking at time, we've got a few other things we wanted to talk about. So yeah, Let's move on. I know there's going to be a lot of people that listen to this podcast that this is going to be super beneficial for. So thank you for sharing. And we might have already covered some of the stuff already, but can you tell us a little bit about managing stress, a little bit more about managing stress? And Phoebe's really keen to hear about this as well, as you can hear in the background there. can you talk about managing stress when living with challenging animals in particular?
Yeah.
How do I manage my stress right now as I'm trying to record a podcast and Phoebe's telling me that something else deserves my attention?
You know, I'm really glad that you brought this up, Ryan, because I myself live with a challenging dog. I have a dog that experiences a lot of anxiety, and as you know, you and I were talking about at the beginning, I've got a 3-month-old, and my dog, she didn't cope very well with the introduction of a new family member. She got really anxious. So I guess I've got a lived experience of living with a challenging animal. So I completely empathize with people that are in that environment. So the first thing that we want to do is you know, understand that, yes, this is a really stressful situation, because, you know, you're living with this animal and there's little opportunity to really get any rest because they're in your home environment. So you can't get away from the stress. So many people can be constantly on guard when they live with a challenging animal, constantly monitoring the dog's environment, if it's a dog, for example. Ensuring the environment's low stress, ensuring it's routine, they can become extra vigilant. So it's also stressful because some people might also choose not to have visitors over anymore. So they might change their routines around that dog, and then people can start becoming quite resentful. And, you know, so there are a number of factors as to why this is really stressful. And another reason why it's stressful is because of what we call emotion contagion. I don't know if you've heard of that before, but we have mirror neurons, and we unconsciously can mimic the emotions that we see in others. And so this has been shown in research where if we watch someone stressing out, our cortisol levels significantly increase. Now, I'm not aware of any research between whether the cortisol levels significantly increase when we're watching an animal stress out, but anecdotally and from my own experience, I'd certainly think that that's the case. So that's another reason why living with an anxious or a challenging animal can be quite stressful, is because of emotion contagion. Now, the third reason I think why living with a challenging animal is stressful for those that are in the animal training environment is that people can start to beat themselves up over it. They might say, well, I'm an animal trainer, why can't I fix this? You know, I'm an expert in behavior, my dog's still behaving reactively, why can't I fix this? This must mean I'm, you know, I suck. So you know, all these factors impact on why this situation is so stressful. So what I think you can do, and I've got four little tips in mind. The first thing you want to do is, again, acknowledge that, yes, this is a really stressful situation. Have a think about what you're saying to yourself, and have a think about what you might be saying if this was a friend experiencing this situation. You might find that the two are very different. Have a think about what you would say to a friend experiencing this situation. Write down the words and read them out to yourself, because sometimes what you might find is that what you're telling yourself is very different to what you would be telling a friend. You might, for example, be saying to yourself, oh my God, I suck at this. You know, I'm a total failure. Why can't I fix this? This must mean I'm no good. If you were telling a friend who was experiencing this situation, you might be very different. You might be very calm and kind. You might be reassuring. So please make sure that you speak to yourself as you would a dear friend. So that's number one. Acknowledge it's a stressful situation, and think about what you would say to a friend who was in that situation, and speak to yourself in that way. Number two, become aware of all the thoughts that are running through your mind in response to this situation. So take a mindfulness attitude towards this situation. Recognize that your beliefs and your thoughts are not necessarily facts. So if you think that you're a failure, it doesn't actually mean that you are one. So write down the thoughts that are going through your mind in regards to this situation. Some of them may be very valid and useful. For example, if you're worried about your challenging animal biting someone that's entering the home, that's a really valid and useful thought to have. So if, however, you're having other thoughts like, you know, this must mean I'm not a very good animal trainer, please do investigate that thought and weigh up the evidence. You know, you may be basing that one situation and generalizing it to your whole career. So have a think about, you know, maybe you've got a lot of positive feedback from the people that you work with. Maybe you've got a lot of certificates and degrees. All of these are evidence against the fact that, you know, you're not a very good animal trainer. So have a think about what thoughts are going through your mind. Investigate those thoughts. Are they valid? Are they useful? Number three, if you recognize that your stress levels are increasing, there are some really quick ways that you can find some calm throughout your day. So three, which I use myself, we have what we call four square breathing. So this is what you can use in response to any stressful situation. So we call four square breathing. So what we do is we breathe in for four. So we breathe in through the nose for four. One, two, three, four. We pause for four. One, two, three, four. And then we exhale for four. And we continue that until we find that we're finding calm, that we're feeling our stress levels decrease. So breathe in for four, hold for four, breathe out for four, hold for four. That's four square breathing. The second little way to find calm is to use some mental imagery. So think about, I don't know if you've watched, is that Happy Gilmore? And he goes to his happy place. So it's a similar kind of thing. So you think about think about a time when you were feeling just awesome, when you were feeling really calm, really happy. Think about where you were. What were the sounds? What was the image like? What were the smells? Really picture that scene in your mind. And whenever you're feeling really stressed out, go back to that. Go back to your happy place. So the third thing that you can do is grounding. And grounding is really useful for not just times when you're living with a challenging animal and you're feeling stressed, but again, all forms of stress. So with grounding, you think about 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. So you think five things you can see, list four things you can touch, three things you can hear, two things you can smell, and one thing you can taste. So that's five things you can see, four things you can touch, three things you can hear, two you can smell, and one that you can taste. So pretty soon, I bet, once you've gone through all of those things, your mind will have gone completely grounded in the present moment, and that can be really great ways to manage stress. Fourth thing, get support from friends, colleagues, and family. Support's really important. It's a really great tool for all stress management. What can happen is when we're stressed, we can start to isolate ourselves. So we need to get support from friends, colleagues, and family. What I find is that when I'm working with animal care professionals, they're experts in their field. They may feel reluctant to ask for help because they believe they should have all the answers. But, you know, we're only human. We don't have all the answers, and that's okay. I don't have all the answers. You know, I deal with stress management. I still get stressed. Stress is a really normal part of life, and it's not always a bad thing. But, you know, it's a sign that maybe if you're feeling overwhelmed, to get some support. So number four, get some support. Get some practical support. Get some emotional support. And that also includes getting some professional help, you know, speaking to a counsellor or other health professional. And also get some education as well. So get some advice from experts as well. If you need to get some advice, if you don't feeling like, you know, you're a bit lost in whatever you're feeling stressed about. And also get some respite. So hang out with friends, do whatever you want to get your mind off it. You know, hang out, do some engage in activities that relax and engage you. Did I say four or five? Because I've got a... Did I say seven?
I don't know. I'm just joking.
But I was also going to say get support from the Animal Training Academy tribe too, because, I've been on Facebook and I can see how supportive you guys are, and I just think it's awesome. It's amazing. So, yeah, I'm really glad that resource exists for people.
Yeah, and what I love about that is that people are being really brave in that space.
Yeah.
And they're sharing these emotions, and then they're getting reinforced. And so we're seeing it increase, which is a great thing. And so I think finding that support network, have you found that it's been challenging for people to find the space where they can actually go and be safe?
Yeah, and I think it really depends on the work environment. You know, I think, as I mentioned before, having a really supportive work environment is a really great protective factor against all forms of stress, including compassion fatigue. And certainly the levels of support really vary in workplaces. So having these, you know, other outlets like the Animal Training Academy tribe is fantastic.
And Do you find people are looking for like a magic button, or when hey, help me deal with stress, give me that magic button I can push and stress will go away, or and these kind of concepts kind of, because I've done similar things in my life, and I do the breathing one, and I find sometimes it can take me a long time to kind of remove myself from stress and bring myself back down into having a clear mind again. How do people in general kind of respond to this kind of stuff? Is it brand new to people to remove yourself and count your breaths and focus on things in your environment, or is it so powerful when people do it that they kind of just, that's the magic button? Well, I hate to use that term. I didn't mean to. Retract that statement.
I think it depends on the person. So for some people, you know, a lot of these stress management techniques are new. For others, they may be aware of them. I think the attitude that we bring towards these behaviors is really important as well. So people might be going, okay, I'm going to engage in meditation for 5 minutes a day for a week, and then find that their stress levels are still high and get disappointed and give up. So what we want to do is, be mindful of what attitude we're bringing. If we've got an expectation that, you know, this is a quick fix and we're automatically going to be fixed and all our problems are going to go away, then we might be self-sabotaging ourselves. So having a kind and gentle attitude towards this is the key, I think.
So just to run through those 4/5/6/7, joking. To run through that list. Number one was acknowledge that this is a super stressful situation, and think about what you might say to your friend versus what you might be saying to yourself. Because I find when people post those kind of posts, I'll unpack what that means in Facebook. So I my dog's doing all of this stuff and I'm feeling useless and like I can't actually do my job of helping other people. If those same people saw someone else write that, they'll jump in quickly and try to say, hey, but I saw you do all this and do all that.
So maybe
you could even frame it like a social media post. Like, what would you say to someone on social media in a comment if you saw that?
Yeah, absolutely. That's a really good point. And because it's very different. And I think we are so much harsher towards ourselves than we are to others, aren't we? I think the reason for it is sometimes it can be humbling, so we don't get too big of a head, but sometimes it's self-sabotage. We end up just being way too harsh on ourselves. So do practice, first one again, practice some self-compassion, be kind to yourself, be aware of what you're telling yourself in your head.
Number two, become aware of all the thoughts.
So
kind of like contrasting thoughts versus facts, stories versus facts.
Yes, absolutely.
Number 3/4/5, I think, were square breathing.
Yes.
So counting your breaths, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. So 5 things you can see, 4 things you can touch, 3 things you can hear, 2 things you can smell, 1 thing you can taste. I haven't done that one, but I've done similar exercises and they've worked really well.
Yeah.
And then the final thing is getting support. So whether that be from friends and family or professional help, even and getting some education. Did I cover everything, or have we missed?
You did an awesome job. Yeah. And also number 5, get support from the tribe. Brilliant.
Ah, yes. Join Animal Training Academy is number 5.
Yeah.
Thank you for that one. So like I said, it's great information. I know there's so many people who this is going to be super beneficial for, so I really appreciate you sharing so far. The last thing we wanted to talk about in another one of your areas of speciality is grief surrounding animal professionals and carers. Can you talk to this for us? Maybe start us off by walking through the different kinds of grief that we might have.
Yeah. So, you know, as you were saying, there are a whole different types of grief. So when we think about grief, we often think that there's only one type, but there's many different types. The first one is, which I think deserves a mention, is when we experience loss, when we lose a companion animal, or when we lose an animal when we're working in the zoo environment, for example. It's often considered a type of disenfranchised grief. So that's one type of grief. It's when the loss isn't officially recognised. For example, when you lose a companion animal, some workplaces may not give you bereavement leave. there aren't rituals like funerals or memorials. So this is an example of disenfranchised grief. And what can happen is that we start to internalize that, and we might be saying to ourselves, oh, I should suck it up. You know, I might not be cut out for this job because I'm experiencing grief. So we kind of disenfranchise our own grief feelings, and that can complicate the grief process and make people feel really quite isolated. So that's one type of grief, disenfranchised grief. Another type of grief is anticipatory grief. So this is when people experience grief feelings in response to an anticipated loss. This is when the animal hasn't died, but they're anticipating the loss. So this can actually provide people with an opportunity to, you know, say goodbye, complete unfinished business. So, for example, this might happen in the zoo environment, or it might happen with your own companion animal where an animal's sick and there's a decision has been made to euthanize the animal. So some people can experience anticipatory grief. Again, this can give people an opportunity to say goodbye, but it doesn't necessarily mean that people won't experience grief after the death too, so we need to be mindful of that. But it's also good to be aware that these grief feelings, if you're feeling grief and the loss hasn't actually occurred, that's really normal. And we also have another type of grief called ambiguous loss. And that's when we experience grief when an animal is physically or psychologically absent. So, for example, we might lose a companion animal. So an animal has become lost. In the zoo environment, an animal may be transferred to another zoo. We can experience ambiguous loss in response to that. So another example of ambiguous loss may be where an owner perhaps may have taken on a dog to find that it's really not a good fit for their home, and they've had to rehome a dog. So you may be exposed to those situations if people are in a training environment. So this type of loss can be particularly stressful to people because it's not really officially recognised or acknowledged. So it can be really difficult for people to find closure with that type of loss. So if anyone does experience this, it can be really useful if you know someone that experiences this ambiguous loss to acknowledge that loss, to help people tell their story and to make sense of that. Another type of grief is traumatic grief. Now, traumatic grief is grief that occurs, a loss that occurs that's sudden and unexpected. So witnessing a dog attack, for example, where unfortunately the victim has passed away, witnessing a hit by car incident. These are very traumatic incidences. So people can experience both grief and trauma symptoms at the same time. There's also another type of loss which affects animal caregivers, and that's a cumulative grief. So this is where we're exposed to multiple losses, like what you were saying, Ryan, when you're working in the zoo, you might be exposed to a lot of death, perhaps a lot of loss with animals being transferred. And these losses can build up over time if we don't take some time out and acknowledge those losses and process them. So that's just a few types of loss, types of grief for you.
Yeah, and you and I were talking when we caught up a few weeks ago as well about one that I feel I see, and maybe it will fit into that ambiguous loss category, where people have brought an animal into their home, or maybe into their zoo collection even, or wherever they're working with animals, and they have expectations in their mind as to what that animal is going to be, but then they possibly grieve for the fact that it's not. It might be a super reactive dog, or and this life they had pictured for themselves with this companion animal is not going to be the life moving forward that they're going to have. Would that fall under a category of grief?
Yeah, definitely. So it's important to realise that you can experience grief feelings even though there is no death. So that can be the loss, the loss of, I guess, of a future that you had pictured with yourself and with that animal. Yeah, that certainly can happen.
And so a message I'm assuming we want to put out there is this: it's not a bad thing if you're feeling any of these things. Maybe you've just had a dog die and you've got to go to work tomorrow and no one pays it any attention. What kind of input can you give to the people that might be listening to this podcast and might identify with some of those labels you've chucked on different types of grief there? What can you say to these people that might help them?
Yeah. First off, to recognize that, you know, again, these are normal reactions to loss. And first off, to understand that there are some grief can affect you, your body, it can affect your mind, and it can affect your emotions as well. So do be kind to yourself during this time, because it does affect it affects our whole body. So be kind to yourself. That's really important thing to do during this time. Acceptance is really important as well. So that can take time. So everybody grieves in their own way, in their own time. There's no right or wrong way to grieve. As long as people aren't hurting themselves or others, then do whatever you need to do to make sense of that loss. Acceptance is really important. So if a death has occurred, decide how you, or even if, for example, there is an ambiguous loss, like an animal has been transferred, decide how you might like to say goodbye. So that might be when a death has occurred, it might be a memorial, for example. Making sense of your loss is really important. So that might be by trying to make sense of it by talking about it. If you're not one to be a big talker, then writing about it can be really helpful as well. And do also be kind to yourself. Take care of yourself during that time. Make sure you're getting enough sleep, that you eat right. But of course, you know, the occasional chocolate I recommend is certainly fine. And if you're finding that these symptoms are overwhelming, that they are affecting your life and that they're prolonged, please do reach out for professional help as well.
That's some great input there. And we will link to all of Vanessa's stuff as well in case you want to seek out potentially input from her or seeing what she's up to over the next few while. Thank you so much for sharing all of us today, Vanessa. We are sadly going to move on to our final question now. You took us back to 6-year-old Vanessa starting her self-help. I don't want to say self-help, but guidance club, whatever you call it. Let's take us forward now, 6 years from now, 5 to 10 years from now. What do you want to see happening in this space? Out of everything you've witnessed in your career thus far, this venture you've started, your PhD, everything you've been learning, and where you are in 2018, where do you want us to take this information moving forward? How can we build upon where we are as a community, as the various industries you touch base with? What can we do better? What would you like to see more of?
Wow, that's a really good question, Ryan. Let me think. What I would like to see is a bit more of what we're doing, you know, a bit more acknowledgement, and a bit more, acknowledge that, you know, experiencing these kinds of emotions is really normal, that it doesn't mean that you're weak. It just is human nature. It means that we care, that it's not a bad thing. I would love to see that happen. I would love to see some greater acknowledgement of emotions in the workplace. Because a lot of the work that we do as animal caregivers, as human caregivers, is emotion work. So what I would also like is that people are much more kinder towards themselves too, and that we become proactive when it comes to mental health, both out of the workplace and inside the workplace as well.
Fantastic vision. I'm pretty certain that no one can disagree with wanting to see these things moving forward. Hey, we've already said it at the start of the episode, but can you just remind everyone, please, Vanessa, where they can go to find out more about you and get in touch?
Say yes, hi. You can. So if you want to get in touch, I'm on Facebook. I'm also on Instagram and LinkedIn, but I also have a website. And if you jump on the website, there's a whole bunch of blogs and articles on there on compassion fatigue and grief, and you can read up all about that. And the website is drvanessarolf.com.au.
And where might we go to learn more about your upcoming projects and workshops. Upcoming,
yeah. So if you just pop on Facebook and like my page, I'll keep you updated on all the upcoming workshops and seminars and on all the news. But also if you want to stay in touch with people and animals in the workplace and any upcoming seminars that people and animals in the workplace, our joint initiative with Dr. Kate Mormont and Mia Cobb, we also have a Facebook page and we also have a website as well. And I'm going to get that for you. It is just one word, no space, peopleandanimalsintheworkplace.com. So you can also check out that website or you can also like the Facebook page as well.
Wonderful. And we will, of course, link to all of this in the show notes for you out there in the podcast audience. Hey, Vanessa, this has been so interesting and hopefully super beneficial for everyone listening. From myself and on behalf of those listening, we really appreciate you taking time today to away from the baby to come and speak to an adult, but also to share your experiences and information. And I think it's going to be super helpful for humans and consequently the animals that they care for. So thank you so much.
Thank you. It's an absolute pleasure to talk about something I feel really passionate about. Thank you.
I look forward to learning more over the coming while. And for those of you out there listening, we, of course, really appreciate you tuning in today as well. If you have enjoyed this episode and you are interested in carrying on the conversation about the human side of working with our animals and, of course, positive reinforcement and all of that other good stuff, then as mentioned at the start of the episode, the Animal Training Academy community is waiting for you. Head on over to www.animaltrainingacademy.com, click on the membership button in the main menu to learn more about what members are describing as a Netflix social media platform for behavior nerds. There's something there for absolutely everyone, and we're looking forward to having you join the tribe. That's it for this episode, though. We're going to wrap it up there. Thanks again so much, everyone, for listening, and you'll hear from us again soon.